Hi, everybody. This is your bubbly host, Jennifer Rosen of Mind Your Nest. And this morning, I'm excited to have my guest in studio today. Dr. Edward Davidson is a board-certified plastic surgeon and the director of Palm Beach Plastic Surgery Institute, specializing in facial surgical reconstruction and rejuvenation. Dr. Davidson established the Palm Beach Plastic Surgery Foundation, which serves to provide access to healthcare, financial assistance, and education to patients with congenital or trauma-related facial differences. Dr. Davidson, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for the kind. Okay.
All right. So, everybody, the reason why Dr. Davidson, or Dr. E, is in studio today is I met him, I think it was a little over a month ago, at a networking event in Palm Beach. And I can't remember how we started chatting, but I was working the room with another friend that I was there with, and we started chatting. And I believe my first comment to you was, you're very well-dressed, number one, and I loved the shirt and tie combination, if you can remember when we chatted about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So I'm old school, old-fashioned, at the ripe old age of 57, and I believe in reverse chivalry. And I believe that it shouldn't just be the man complimenting the lady. It should be the lady complimenting the man. And I thought you looked extremely sharp.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. So we started chatting and learned a little bit about you, obviously where you're from. Will you let our listeners know where you're from?
I grew up in England, in the north of England, in a city called Leeds in Yorkshire. It's not as pioneering as the name would suggest. Most people, it's halfway between London and Edinburgh. It's not really on the tourist trail. People know it from The Who live at Leeds for people of that generation. Then being in the States for about 15 years.
Okay. I love the fact that you still have your accent. It still seems
my parents think I sound very American these
days.
Oh,
no. We'll have to get to that conversation in a few minutes. We started chatting, and the woman that I was with, was, I think Sheila was in her 70s, maybe. We were having this really light conversation. And I think that I joked with you that maybe you could do a twofer with Sheila and myself and do our eyes. And to that, you started joking and we went on and enjoyed the rest of the evening. That was on a Friday evening. And I thought, I truly believe that there are no coincidences in life, that we're meant to meet certain people at a certain time. So of course, what did I do? I called his office on Monday morning. And I scheduled a consultation. And then I went in on Wednesday. And I know you were so excited to see me. I know that. And I decided that I was going to get my eyes done. Why not? You only live once. You get one chance around the sun. And I figured, let's do this. We talked about how I knew that you were the doctor for me just based on my experience and my feeling and understanding of moving forward and trusting somebody to do a surgery and being a patient of theirs. But can you talk to me a little bit about the importance of picking the right plastic surgeon?
So I think that's a really important aspect of everything we've been talking about. While I'm extremely chuffed that you picked me based off a personal interaction, which is important, you've absolutely got to fundamentally, the doctor-patient relationship is the sacrosanct relationship.
Right.
And you've got to be able to trust that person and feel a bond with them throughout that perioperative period and beyond. It's just as it's very hard to work for someone you don't respect. We've all had jobs where you don't like your boss. It's very hard to be high-functioning in that environment. Similarly, you need to have an affinity personally, I think, for the plastic surgeon. But above that, the single most important thing, I think, for anyone out there considering embarking on plastic surgery is to make sure that the plastic surgeon you're going to is board certified in plastic surgery. That means they've done a plastic surgery residency and they're certified by the American Board of Plastic Surgery. You'll see a lot of people saying they're board certified, but is that board certification truly in plastic surgery? I love pediatricians. I love emergency medicine people. I work with these people all the time, but you don't want to go to a plastic surgeon who, someone calling themselves a plastic surgeon whose board certification is in one of these other specialties. Just as you wouldn't want me saying I'm a pediatrician.
Correct.
Based on being a plastic surgeon. I do pediatric plastic surgery, but I'm not a pediatrician, right? And I think that's very important. So I think that's the first thing, but definitely when you meet with them, making sure you do have a good interaction with them and you feel they're communicative and they're listening to your needs and they're on board with the plan. And there's nothing wrong with getting many opinions. When you go and buy a house, you don't just see a house and think, oh, I love this house, I'm going to buy it. It's still good to see some houses that you don't like.
Right.
And if a lot of people are telling you a different thing, or two people tell you, to get a third opinion. Mm-hmm. So that would be my recommendation.
Are there any warning signs when somebody is going for a consult and they're all gung-ho? Are there any questions or conversations that should maybe wake them up a little bit, that maybe this isn't the right match for them? Any suggestions from the surgeon or recommendations where it might seem too good to be true?
That's difficult to say. There is an element where you do have to go with your gut. Mm-hmm. I think making sure someone's board certified, do you have a good relationship with them? Obviously, is this an area of plastic surgery they do a lot of? I'll be the first to admit, my practice is by far and away specialized in treating differences, either through age or an acquired issue of the face. I don't do breast implants. I don't do breast reconstruction. If a patient comes to see me for that, I refer them to another plastic surgeon who I know is, you know, an expert in that subspecialty of plastic surgery. That being said, there's many plastic surgeons who have a broad range of what they offer, and that's fine too. And I think when you meet with someone, you really ask the potential surgeon about the perioperative expectations, it should become clear to you whether this is someone who has an experience in doing this and they know what they're doing. Obviously, look at their testimonials, get a feel from their staff. And if, like I alluded to before, if you're unsure about having surgery, don't have it. You've got to be sure, and it's got to work for you. And I never try and be pushy. Other people out there that are pushy, perhaps, is that a bad thing? That's up to you to decide. But I think the one thing you do have that I think it's prudent objectively to make sure of is the board certification aspect.
And is there a way for somebody to ask for references, really find out if their doctor is board certified? What if somebody had their license revoked? If somebody was really looking to get into the weeds to find out, is this doctor legitimate?
Obviously, patients, physicians tend to say on their websites or whatever publications that they're giving to patients, whether they're board certified or not. Now we're getting into, could someone lie about that? Sure. How do you verify it? Right. Yes, you can go on the American Board of Plastic Surgery website. And mm-hmm. I haven't checked this, but I'm assuming, I know there is. You can search. And similarly, the American Society of Plastic Surgery, okay. which is a professional organization, I'd say most, but not all mm-hmm. board-certified plastic surgeons are part of ASPS. You can certainly search there to verify people too.
Okay.
If that answers the question.
The reason why I asked this question is we briefly talked about the show Botched mm-hmm. and how some of their patients have gone out of the country and have gone to not really backyard plastic surgeons, but have been a patient of a plastic surgeon that might not have been who he says he or she was. Thank you for clarifying that.
I think what you're talking about, plastic surgery tourism, mm-hmm. it's why people doing it, because it's cheaper, right?
Oh,
right. They've got to ask themselves, but at what cost?
Exactly. You know,
surgery is not an event. It's a process. Mm-hmm. What about the follow-up? You talk about credentials, safety. See a lot of complications from people traveling for plastic surgery. There's many excellent plastic surgeons internationally, of course, mm-hmm. and there's also problems with people having their lips injected. I've seen this in my office recently, lips injected with non-medical grade silicone in a hotel room in Miami.
Oh my goodness. And so what happens with that when they come see you?
They have these what we call silicone granulomas or lumps in their lips. And for something that was initially, I don't want to call it frivolous, but a relatively frivolous thing. Mm-hmm. Some young, attractive girl wanted to have her lips plumped up a little bit, thought this was a cheaper option than filler in a plastic surgeon's office or a dermatologist's office or whomever's offering filler, and do this. And now they have a problem. And that's devastating for that person, because it's something that could be avoided with a little bit of due diligence.
And so what happened with that patient?
The particular patient I'm referencing, and I've seen a few like this, that have to have surgery to have those granulomas removed.
Oh my gosh.
If conservative measures do not work, uh-huh. which for some particular individuals I've seen for this, it doesn't. And that's just one example.
And did this patient go through with it, the procedure, with having them corrected?
The patient just sprung to mind right now is considering it.
Okay.
But I have done it in the past for those things.
And then once the patient goes through that, are you happy with what their lips look like after the fact? And was the patient happy with that? Did they feel relieved that maybe their misstep, obviously, in having something injected for short-term feel good is happy with the results that you were able to go in and correct that?
Yeah, I think more broadly speaking, anytime you're seeing a patient to treat a complication, mm-hmm. it's that you haven't performed their original surgery. It's always, again, about managing their expectations. Right. And a lot of the time, things are never going to be back to how they were. Right. But a lot of the time, they can be. And as long as you're open and honest and manage expectations in advance, then I think most of those patients are happy in the most part.
Okay. Thank you very much. So can you talk to me a little bit about my first consultation and how you decide and work with a potential patient on what they should have done and your recommendations, along with if you feel the patient wants more done than you feel is appropriate, how do you handle that conversation?
All great questions. And let me just take it back a little bit to that initial encounter, because it's actually something that happens some degree of frequency mm-hmm. when I meet people out and about in the wild as opposed to in the office, and people realize I'm a plastic surgeon. That's a very classic response that people say, oh, can you do this? Can you do that? And it's always posed in this sort of joking way. But such as with yourself, a lot of times this underlying element of seriousness to it.
Right.
And it's actually hard to navigate that initial encounter.
Mm-hmm.
And I still don't really know how to manage it, because obviously I do want to be a professional source of information for people, even if it is a curbside consult, as you might call it. So I just try and now be pretty open about it and say, I'm not sure if you're joking or you're serious, but if you're serious, I'm happy to help you and can always come to the office and we can speak in a more formal way, because the last thing you want is when people are out and about enjoying themselves in their social time is to start picking on them, for want of a better phrase, about
right.
certain things they may not be happy with about their appearance. But that being said, once that hurdle has been overcome and a patient does come and see me in the office, my job is really to give patients information to mm-hmm. help them make educated decisions. And even if one of the other classic phrases that you hear as a plastic surgeon from people saying is, why don't you tell me what I need?
Right.
No one really needs anything.
Correct.
My response is always, why don't you tell me what you're unhappy with? Because the choice to embark on surgery, or even if it's a non-surgical intervention, it's an important decision and it shouldn't be taken lightly, and it should come, I think, from you. And it's not really my place to say, oh, I think you should have this done, I think you should have that done. And for someone to be happy with the end result,
mm-hmm.
they really have to have a goal that they want to achieve. So I think if patients are, and we're talking about anti-aging or cosmetic plastic surgery, come to me because they're not quite sure, but they're not exactly happy with
mm-hmm.
what they see compared to maybe how they looked 10, 15 years ago, we do a thorough facial examination together where we literally go from the hairline down to the chin and we talk about the classic changes we see in facial anatomy with age and how for that particular person or patient, it equates to them, whether it's lines on the forehead, whether it's the eyebrow being a bit droopy, excess skin of the upper lids of the eye, lower lids, excess fat there, how the cheek can move down with time and how that can create deeper lines around the mouth, and then something as so complementary as jowling, as we call it, or changes in the neck. And obviously that's an extremely brief overview, but when I sit with any patient, as I sat with you, we really go from top to bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And I do usually preface it by saying, I am not picking on you here.
Right.
If you were to compare this to how you looked 10 years ago, these are likely the changes. And then really asking the patient, what are the changes they want to address that have occurred to reconstruct what's come about from time and aging. And I think it's important really to keep things in balance. Again, talking about eyes, often patients come in to talk about, say, the upper lids or the lower lids. And while I'm not trying to upsell them, as it were, it's always important to me to make sure at the end of their treatment, a patient has a balanced appearance
mm-hmm.
perioral around the eyes. So if someone really, their main concern is their upper lids, and they're probably so focused on that they haven't seen their lower lids, that's a discussion that I would signpost them towards. But I think overall, my focus is on achieving really natural results. And so a patient could come in and say, I want horns and a tail. And they can probably find someone that's out there willing to do it, but I'm certainly not willing to do that.
Right.
And I think a patient's level of concern about a particular aspect of their appearance really should be proportional to the severity. So if someone's, I can't sleep at night or live with my, mm-hmm. and the jowling's very subtle and mild, then that's going to be a hard patient to make happy, right? Because it's their level of concern is out of proportion with the issue severity.
For our audience, can you explain what jowling is and where that's located?
It reminds me of an exercise when I was interviewing for medical school and they asked me how to serve a tennis ball without moving my hands or drawing anything and to describe something, mm-hmm. obviously over a podcast instead of in person. But jowling is where we see soft tissue, skin, muscle, and fat descending with time and gravity from the cheek down through the lower face. And really when you see it beginning to not distort, but cloud the appearance of the lower jawline, because you have this sort of soft tissue jowling, like when you think of a dog, like a bulldog, how they have those kinds of jowls around their mouth.
Good description. For those of you that are closing your eyes, trying to imagine where your jowling line is.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go back a little bit. Can you tell me, number one, we know where you're from, but how did you get into this business? Did you always want to be?
I always wanted to be a plastic surgeon. Wow. I really don't know where it came from originally. You can look at what you would call home movies of me when I was a little kid, and I always wanted to be a plastic surgeon from a very young age. And I feel extremely fortunate because there's many people who have these childhood ambitions to be an astronaut or fireman or the next John Bon Jovi. But for me, it was to be a plastic surgeon. And I feel extremely fortunate that I've been able to reach that goal. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just me being stubborn. Maybe if I wanted to be the next John Bon Jovi, I could have been out on stage.
Right. You definitely have the hair, the spiky hair, which you would definitely fit right in.
I don't want people to think I have the 80s Bon Jovi.
No, he does not, everybody. Okay, so did you spend your academic life in England, or where were you when you decided you were ready to study?
So after high school in England, naturally in most European countries, after high school, there is no sort of college. You go straight from high school to medical school. So after high school, I did 6 years of medical school. I was at the University of Cambridge, and then we have the opportunity in Cambridge to do our preclinical there and then our clinical in London. So I did my clinical training, and after that, 3 years in Cambridge in London. Cambridge is a really small town. Obviously, London's a big city, so you get much more broader experience. Mm. So I did my clinical training there, and then it was in my penultimate year of medical school. We get 2 months of what we call elective time, where you can go somewhere else, and I chose to spend that in New York at NYU, and it really opened my eyes to the surgical training in this country, and that became a goal. So I returned to England, did a sort of intern year that I was already contracted to do, and then I came out to 2 years of research at NYU, retook all of my exams. I felt like I went to medical school twice and applied for plastic surgery residencies and was fortunate to what we call MATCH, at what you could argue is the premier program in the country at the University of Pittsburgh.
Very nice. Excellent. I wanted to ask you, or actually, I first wanted to mention, I forgot to include this. When I first met you at that event, I remember specifically asking you, can you tell who in this room has had any work done? And I loved your answer. You said, well, if they had it done by me, you wouldn't be able to tell at all. And that's when I realized I'm definitely calling him on Monday. Okay, so talk to me about when you were first getting into your residency and starting to perform on patients. What were some of the most challenging surgeries that you had to either observe and or participate in when you were first starting out?
So I would say every surgery, people always ask, oh, is this a serious surgery? Is this a big surgery? Mm-hmm. All surgery is serious, okay? And sometimes it can be, as a surgeon, those more complex, longer cases with many steps where you are very preoccupied in your mind thinking about it in the days before, the night before, something like that, or knowing, oh, I've got that big surgery next week. But often it's the quote-unquote smaller surgeries, the more, I don't want to call them mundane, but the sort of bread and butter, the things we do more frequently, mm-hmm. that sometimes they can throw up a complication too. Any operation can have a complication, and really the only surgeons that don't have complications are those that don't operate, is the old adage. But I think the preparation for all surgery, whether it's a relatively minor thing or a relatively major thing, is the same, always thinking about what if, and making sure the patient's in the safest possible environment. So anytime I'm doing a procedure, when I meet with any patient, it's really, I'm not thinking about what am I going to do? How's the surgery going to work? I'm always thinking, what particular aspects about this patient put him or her at risk of a complication.
Right.
And how do we mitigate that risk and control that risk as much as possible? All surgery has risk, but we want to minimize any controllable risk. And then equally, how's this patient going to be if they were to get a complication or a result they weren't happy with or something that was slightly suboptimal? About managing expectations. So I think that the challenge with surgery is really managing complications, which are rare, but when they happen, you want to be able to manage them. And I think that's why when you're choosing a surgeon or a provider, that's why I really love what I do in terms of reconstruction, because I do think it's a great complement to cosmetic surgery and the other way around, because I see patients for revision surgery and then the lines between what is cosmetic and what is reconstructive get blurred because maybe I'm reconstructing something that was what we call iatric created or a pathology that was created.
What is a revisionist surgery?
So revision surgery, say if you'd had your eyes done or what we call a blepharoplasty and you weren't happy with the result mm-hmm. or there was a problem with the result or a complication, the eyelid gets pulled down or something like that, correcting that.
Got it. Sort of like what they do on Botched, but not really.
Exactly like that. I don't watch that show religiously, but I've seen it a couple of times. And yes, I think everything they're doing is revision surgery, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken.
I do remember when I first went in for my initial consultation, I didn't really have any fear going into the discussion and or obviously the eventual surgery. I trust my gut and I just go with it. So I had complete faith in you. Even before I was in your office, for some reason, I figured, oh, he's at this event, so he must be legit. But I do have to say, the one thing that I think I had communicated with you that really was not really a worry, but more of how am I going to deal with this, were the sutures on the end of my eyes for that first week was probably the most challenging. And that's because of the procedure that I had, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And what was the procedure that I had called?
So you had an upper and lower lid blepharoplasty mm-hmm. with a campopexy, which is where we support the corner of the eye. So the suture that you're talking about for the listeners. So if you think about the lower eyelid and what we call the margin of the lid, which is part of the lid that essentially touches the eye where the eyelashes are, you can think of that as like a clothesline, right? And we all know if you put wet clothes on a clothesline that isn't tight, that's going to pull down that clothesline.
Right.
So if you're tightening someone's lower lid, you're going to pull down on that lid margin. And to stop that from happening, we want to make sure that lid margin is tight. And that's what that campopexy is. And then I put in without getting into too much jargon, a temporary tarsora suture. Mm-hmm. Whereas barbaric as it sounds, I sew the upper to the lower eyelid in the corner there just to support it as it's getting swollen for a week. And that's the suture that you're talking about. But I think, imagine if I hadn't told you in that level of granularity that mm-hmm. you'd have this suture
right.
and you'd hate me for it. But I prefer you to hate me for a week than forever.
Right.
It's about managing expectations. And yep. I think you knew it was there. And I try yep. and make out it's worse than it is. And mm-hmm. in the end, it's not such a big deal. You are glad, obviously, when that suture comes out.
Oh, my gosh. I have to say that I was so excited, number one, to get to the office 1 week later to get that out. And this isn't to scare anybody. But again, you just don't know what it's going to feel like to have it removed. You can't wait for it to be removed, but removing the one on my right eye was definitely worse than the one on my left, and you were right. So you're like, oh, it's just going to pinch a little bit, and it pinched a little. It's just a weird sensation mm-hmm. if you're not used to having something bolted down and then it's getting removed, but it was great. And I do have to say that I've had a few procedures done in my life. I had a breast reduction when I was senior in college, 1989, and I had a tummy tuck many years ago, and I'm not a poster child for plastic surgery. Definitely not into putting anything in my body. Like, I've never had Botox or whatever those other things are that people put in their face to reduce fine lines and wrinkles. But I definitely have to say that, and maybe this is at my mother's nagging over the years, my Jewish mother, I know, and I communicated this to you, that she had been jonesing me to get my eyes done. And so I finally gave in and my procedure was done on her 84th birthday. And I do have to say that she is so thankful and grateful to you for me deciding to say yes. Something that I wanted to talk about, which I know is very near and dear to your heart, is the Palm Beach Plastic Surgery Foundation. So can you talk to me about that foundation? Who created it, who established it, and who gets to be the recipient of what services you provide there?
Yes, so the Palm Beach Plastic Surgery Foundation is a charitable arm of our practice. I established it. We're a registered charity. We have a 501c3, of course. And then it's a mechanism to provide, truthfully, money, pragmatically speaking, for simple things like patients that would want to come and see us, but literally can't pay for the transportation to get to our office. Mm-hmm. Or if they were to have surgery and the family are taking time off work, that's really going to impact their ability to even afford groceries or things that are just part of the weekly household situation. So it's financial assistance for often kids that are born with facial differences, also the people that have acquired them through trauma or cancer. And that's the sort of main mission that I think that if someone has one of those differences that you would otherwise could help, they shouldn't be precluded from getting that because of financial issues.
And can you tell me what's the youngest patient you ever performed surgery on?
So I've performed surgery on a patient that's of a day of life one.
Oh, wow. Was it craniofacial disfigurement?
So sometimes if a craniofacial difference is affecting a patient's airway or their ability to breathe, mm-hmm. then that can be an indication for an emergent intervention. And there's few emergencies in plastic surgery.
Right.
But yeah, in a very controlled, specialized way, there's certain conditions where a child can be born and their jaw is so diminutive or set back that it's really collapsing essentially their windpipe. And by performing an operation on their jaw in the absolute neonatal period, it's called neonatal destruction osteogenesis for those who are fascinated by this, then we can essentially move their jaw and prevent them having a tracheostomy or that incision in their neck to have a temporary airway.
So in that situation, how does the coordination of care work, given the fact that this is a brand new baby?
So sometimes we know prenatally a patient that's going to be at high risk, and sometimes we just don't. And I think what you've spoken to is the importance of having expertise and a multidisciplinary team.
Yes.
And to the outside looking in, like, oh, how does everyone know what they're doing? And it's much like when you look at a Formula One pit stop, if it was you and me there, it would be a fiasco, right?
Completely.
Because we don't know what we're doing, and take forever. I don't know how to change a tire. They'd be gas or petrol all over the place. We'd set fire.
I'd be hula hooping or something like that.
It would be a complete fiasco.
Yeah.
But that's the ballet of healthcare in a team. When it's done right, everyone knows their roles. We're not doing this for the first time. And we have a cleft craniofacial program through Palm Beach Children's Hospital at St. Mary's Medical Center. And all the elements of a team that when something like that happens, there's an immediate communication. This is a situation. Plan is rapidly put together in terms of timing and logistics, and we're able to have a protocolized way of doing it that's safe and reproducible.
How do you handle, in a situation like that, post-surgery and with all the follow-ups with the family of, let's say, this newborn? I would assume that the family members, the mother, are beyond grateful for your services and the rest of the team's services, and potentially a very emotional way, because potentially the child was at risk of not having a life, basically. So as a doctor, how do you control when a patient of yours or a family member of a patient has such gratitude and appreciation and may be very emotional when expressing that appreciation to you, potentially breaking down, hugging you incessantly, all of those things? I do know that doctors sometimes, there's a presumption that there's no emotion there, right?
Especially an English doctor. We don't do well with expressed emotion.
Correct. Although I do have to say you're an anomaly. You have a very snappy sense of humor, so I'm very grateful for that. Do you ever react in an emotional way once you get home and you're in private because you've saved a life?
Truthfully, I would say that's very rare. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it's me particularly or that I'm a product of my training and the vocationality of what I do, mm-hmm. that it comes down to compartmentalization. That almost no matter how fantastic or how bad an individual like case or day may be, that you have to have some manner of being able to compartmentalize it. That's not to say I don't lament on things that have happened, as I think everybody does, no matter what your line of work or whatever your passion is. But I think I do. I am able to compartmentalize it. And it's, for me, it's almost like rationalized emotion, mm-hmm. if you will, like have a moment of thoughtful consideration and thinking about something that'll weigh on my mind, but I won't say there's this outpouring of tears once I close the door.
Yes. No, I understand.
When I get home at the end of the day.
Exactly.
It'll be unusual. And maybe that's, again, maybe that's me as a person, or maybe it's the nature of the medical profession, or a combination of the two.
Right. That's a very honest answer. And I would imagine that makes sense, because you're right. You're here to do a job, and you have to table the emotion and just get down to business.
But I really don't think of it as a job. I often think
I didn't mean it like that.
Yeah. When you become a doctor, it's actually, we've been tagged this name, Dr. whatever, Dr. Davidson, Dr. E, whatever you want to call me.
Right.
When you think about that in its essence, you are truly like changing your name. It's not, you're a doctor, whether you're in the operating room, whether you're asleep, whether you're sitting on a beach on vacation, it's who you are, not just what you do. And I don't need to think just because I don't go home and cry my eyes out when I see something sad, that doesn't mean I care deeply.
Right.
And I sometimes think that ostensibly unemotional people are actually very deeply emotional, but they don't show it necessarily.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I tend to believe that is true, because there's a reason why you became a plastic surgeon, as you've described, and you are one and the same. Your personal and your professional existence are the same, which I believe to be true as well. So there's no real differentiation between the two. So talk to me about a patient that comes in and wants some improvement to his or her face. And for everybody out there, you don't just do surgeries for the females, do you?
No, I would say I have been surprised how much male aesthetic surgery we have done this year already. I think it's just becoming, long are the days when plastic surgery or cosmetic plastic surgery was really just perceived as being for women. Yeah, and it's blepharoplasty, facelift, rhinoplasty. They're the three most common cosmetic procedures that we perform. And definitely, it's almost an even split, actually, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
And do men get, because you do Botox, right? You don't just, in addition to plastic surgery, what other services can patients get when they walk into your office?
So I'm a big believer that even though people think of plastic surgery as maybe different to other aspects of medicine, I think the fundamentals are still true. You take a history, you examine the patient, and you make a diagnosis, and the diagnosis leads to the plan. But even in something like this, a diagnosis, if that's lines on the forehead, lines of the glabella, which is the area between the brows, or lines of the crow's feet, which is the lines, the smile lines around the eyes. If that's the diagnosis, then what's the treatment for that? The treatment for that isn't surgery. It's actually Botox, which smooths out those lines. So lines in the upper third of the face tend to be caused by muscle. If you relax those muscles, the lines will soften or even go away. Lines of the middle and lower face tend not to be from muscle, but tend to be caused by the junction of tissues that have descended with gravity over time. And that won't be fixed by Botox. There are some exceptions to that. Some people have like smoker's lines around the mouth, which are caused by muscle and things like that. So I think it's about making a diagnosis and offering the treatment. So in terms of the full spectrum of what we do, as well as making a diagnosis, it's not just what the issue is, but it's how severe it is. So often if something's minimal or mild, you can camouflage it. So that's where things like filler may come in, to try and fill in some of those lines of the middle and lower face that aren't caused by muscle, but caused by a junction of tissues descending. You can hide that junction with some filler. But if things get to be more moderate or even significant, then you have to be a little bit wary about trying to get too much out of something that's camouflaging, because that's when people can start to look unnatural, overdone, or a bit weird, because you're then distorting things rather than reconstructing things back to how they should be. But that being said, yes, so we offer medical-grade skincare. Often patients will come to see me and they'll be unhappy. And when we go through everything, there's not really anything anatomic, but it's just their skin quality, especially being down here in Florida and sun exposure. I think good quality skincare, it can make a massive difference. It's actually similarly, sometimes I say to people, you know, when we go through the whole evaluation, the thing that jumps out as maybe giving away their age or wanting to have a little bit more radiance to their face is their smile. And maybe it's their teeth. I'm like, and this is coming from a British person, maybe get your teeth whitened and your teeth straightened. It can make a big difference. Exactly. That plus skincare can make a big difference to someone. And certainly if you're going to be investing of your money, emotion, time to have, say, surgery, whether it's a facelift, to do that and not look after your skin is equivalent to getting a Ferrari and putting in whatever the crappy petrol at the, right, whatever diesel, I don't know. I think it's, and I think the other thing about plastic surgery that I really try and have patients embrace is not just coming in and seeing it as an event. I want this done and mm-hmm. then I'm done. And I'm not saying you have to be some sort of addict to having surgery, but it's about what we talk about in the office, are like, they get it, right? You know, Okay, they're on board with, yes, I want to do the skincare. I'm going to do the prevention. I'm going to do the maintenance with the Botox and really getting the most out of the whole sort of package or the protocol, the powers in the protocol.
Yeah, no, I understand that. You're either all in or you're not. You either embrace the whole process and have a part in improving your look and heeding your direction instead of sitting, coming in for a consult, feeling all ready to go and energized and then leaving and not putting anything into action. There's really nothing you could do there.
Yeah, I'm not saying we're like some cult where people are joining
this
thing.
No, I understand.
Obviously, yes, if someone has a primary focus, mm-hmm. it's part of like greater well-being. Would I do a facelift on someone that smokes or someone that health is maybe stop smoking? What about someone who comes in with, you know, obesity? Yeah. Right? I mean, I'm not trying to disparage anyone who's overweight, but fundamentally as a doctor, my job is to help them get more healthy.
Yeah.
And so a facelift on an obese person who smokes, yes, that's a higher rate of complication. And is that the most ethical thing that I can do to help them? And I think what we try and do is, it's funny, this whole thing is about mind your nest, and nest is a womb. And we really talk about patients being in the womb of our practice and almost babying them and mm-hmm. mothering them and really helping them. And I think if someone comes in, it's often part of a wider discussion that, yes, they may have this particular concern and we do want to help them address that. Mm-hmm. We want to do it in the safest and most holistic way.
Have you had an experience where you had a patient in the office that you felt like needed some guidance in that direction in terms of taking care of themselves first, deciding to stop some unhealthy habits and get healthy and then go forward with the procedure? Have those been difficult conversations for you to have with a potential patient? And how do they respond typically to you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a conversation that happens frequently. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about smoking because we just mentioned that, especially down here, I feel in South Florida, especially the patients that come up to see us from, say, Miami, where vaping just seems to have gone crazy.
Yeah.
And by medicalizing everything, I always tell people, I have no moral judgment on what you choose to do.
Right? Exactly.
But I'll tell you this, any nicotine products 4 weeks before and 4 weeks after surgery increases your risks of complications. You need to really consider stopping that. Otherwise, you risk some sort of wound healing complication. And by the way, if you're going to stop for 4 weeks before and 4 weeks after, you know, again, it's an opportunity to use this to maybe consider stopping smoking. But that's up to you.
Yeah.
Okay. I think a similar conversation with obesity. No one likes to be said, oh, we can't do your surgery because you're obese. Obviously, I try not to phrase things like that.
Oh, of course not.
But you can medicalize these things. You say to someone, your BMI, your body mass index is 35, right? We know that a BMI over 30 is officially obese and it mm-hmm. just increases your risk of complications. It is improving your BMI something that you're interested in doing? Because if it is, one, we should hold off surgery till you're at your ideal weight.
Right.
Two, you're going to have a better result if you can get your BMI down. And sometimes it's about actually being a quarterback for their healthcare. Often patients don't really have regular preventative healthcare, or they're not seeing anyone regularly because they don't have a quote unquote a medical problem.
Yep.
And they come to see us. And then it's an opportunity to then re-engage them in their own healthcare. And some of these issues can be medicalized. Like we've helped patients that wanted to stop smoking, never really thought about it because they thought it was impossible. And we can say, you can get help. We can send you to smoking cessation programs that are a medicalized way of helping you with this, or bariatric surgery, or weight loss medication, which is obviously huge at the moment.
Yeah.
And getting patients enrolled in those kinds of opportunities to improve their overall health as an adjunct to any surgery.
Okay, so let's talk about the craze with the diet pill. One I know is Ozempic. So I'm sure you've had patients or people coming in for consults that are taking it, have taken it, want to take it. What are your thoughts on the public who don't meet the criteria of taking it for medical, for diabetes, and taking it for weight loss? Do you have a concern about that for patients that are looking for help from you for plastic surgery, if they're currently taking that medication or want to take that medication as a conduit to start the weight loss process in hopes of having you perform surgery on them?
So first of all, I'd say that Ozempic, Mounjaro, all these semaglutides are an absolutely fantastic advancement in medicine. We all know in the Western world, obesity, diabetes, it's becoming an epidemic. And this is a huge advance. And I think the indications of who should take it, how they should take it, are evolving. And I think like with anything in medicine, it behooves us to have anything managed by an expert. So yes, I have patients ask me if I'll prescribe it. I don't prescribe it. I refer them to someone who is an expert, who this is what they do as part of their practice. Because like with everything, there's potential complications and side effects, and we can certainly talk about those. But I think patients need to be a little bit wary and get the information from an expert to help them make a decision about whether it's right for them. And we refer patients all the time to whether it's internal medicine or weight loss specialists or physicians that are managing this much more frequently than obviously I would be. And then the sort of second spin of this is, well, what this Ozempic face, as it's been called, or the sequelae of taking these medications. And we're definitely seeing a lot of that, just like we saw when bariatric surgery, gastric bypasses, gastric bands was growing. We began to see a lot of body contouring surgery and even changes in the face. But what are we, this, what I think these semaglutide medications, we are seeing situations where it's creating a lot of deflation in patients' faces, obviously losing the fat, changes in the quality of the skin, and patients seeking cosmetic surgery after that's been pretty common.
Interesting. All right, a couple more, and then we're going to wrap this up. So I remember we were talking, I think it was either before or after my procedure, and I can't remember how it came up that I suffer from mild to moderate sleep apnea, and talked about that I wore a mouth guard, that I couldn't stand the CPAP machine. Being a single woman, I didn't feel like I was going to put CPAP eligible on my profile. And you had mentioned that you can perform a surgery to move the jaw or to correct the jaw to help alleviate sleep apnea sufferers. It's very interesting to me. I think I said that I didn't want to be a repeat patient of yours, but you never know. So can you talk to me a little bit about that? Because it is fascinating that there is a procedure that can hopefully lessen the side effects of sleep apnea.
I'm sorry you don't want to be a repeat patient of mine. It's not exactly the greatest testimonial I've received.
For those out there, he did tell me that the recovery time was a little more intense than the eyes, but it's still on the table.
So just like we talked about that one-day-old baby that had jaw surgery to fix their airway because of the way they were born, that obviously speaks to how powerful jaw surgery can be in affecting the airway. And there are many reasons why someone may have sleep apnea. There's essentially several levels to where there can be a blockage in the airway. That's what we call the nasopharynx at the level of the nose, the oropharynx and lower. There's essentially three levels. And the CPAP is really treating symptoms. There's also the tongue nerve stimulators that help move the tongue and open up the airway. And you can say I'm biased, but the most powerful way to not just treat sleep apnea, but cure sleep apnea is jaw surgery. And what we call maxillomandibular advancement. The maxilla is the upper jaw, the mandible is the lower jaw. You can surgically, through incisions inside the mouth, so no scars, actually cut the maxilla, cut the mandible, and bring it forward so your teeth still come together normally because you haven't changed that relationship. By bringing that forward, it opens up the airway at the back, as it were.
Okay.
You've really just expanded it. And the scientific research data will tell you it's 80% curative. But it's, if you select your patients properly, it's probably higher than that.
Okay.
And this is surgery I perform fairly frequently. And I would say, I don't know, 100% for sure. But my understanding is that every patient I've done this for who's been on CPAP is no longer on CPAP. And
wow.
And it's, and patients always say the same thing. They spend one or two nights in the hospital. And that first night in the hospital, they say, this was the greatest night's sleep I've had in as long as I can remember.
Seriously?
So it's extremely powerful. And mm-hmm. like the main problem with CPAP is compliance. And when you consider that having sleep apnea that's untreated mm-hmm. reduces life expectancy and is associated with so many other serious things.
Yeah.
But obviously people don't think about it because it sounds very major. You're going to break my jaw.
Right.
You know, people always say, you're going to break my jaw.
No.
And it's a controlled thing. It's not like I'm punching them in the face when they're under anesthesia. It's a very controlled, what we call osteotomy or cuts in the bone mm-hmm. that brings everything forward. And speak about the recovery. It's
yes.
actually not that much different from what you've had. Because what you had, you remember those first 2 weeks, you're a bit bruised. And then after, I tell a joke with patients that come to me for jaw surgery that I don't see you for the first 2 weeks because you hate me for the first 2 weeks. And then after that, it's okay, I'll see you. Obviously, I'm available to patients always. But
right.
you know, typically, the routine first follow-up visit is after 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And after 2 weeks, though, the patients are doing pretty good. And similarly, like I said to you, by that 1 month after visit, by mm-hmm. that 6 weeks, when the bones are healed at 6 weeks, patients are back to eating and actually doing pretty good. And at the time, those 6 weeks seemed like a long time.
Yes.
But a year, two, three, five, 10, 20 years after that,
yeah.
that six-week period is a nothing.
I have to agree with you on that. Post-procedure and taking it one day at a time and then going to see you for my first follow-up and then the second. And I do see measurable differences. And it is amazing. You're my hero, basically. And it really is something when you get to see the changes that you decided you were ready to gift yourself with by having a procedure. I guess I have to backpedal a little bit and say that, I don't know, maybe I'll consider doing the jaw surgery. The sleep apnea thing really is such a disruptor in getting good sleep and feeling your best in every single day, because it does affect you in such a sometimes intense way to your overall well-being. Talk to me just a little bit about having this surgery, and is there any improvements from a visual looking at your face that you notice after this procedure?
That's actually an insightful question. Probably think I planted it, but I
yes.
actually didn't. Because
if nobody can tell that I'm really trying to get all the bugs out of me going forward with a second visit to Dr. E.
Any surgery, if you're unsure about it, don't do it. But
right.
I think when you talk about maxillomandibular advancement for sleep apnea,
mm-hmm.
it actually does have a visual benefit. We
okay.
move the jaw about a centimeter forward.
Okay.
And what that does is it's the reverse of a facelift. Not, it doesn't make you look older. I'm saying it achieves some similar results, but in a different way. Instead of tightening the skin from the outside, facelift, we're like blowing up a balloon to skeletally expand, and it then, by changing the foundation, essentially tightens or redrapes the skin around it. So we know that skeletal expansion is associated with a more youthful appearance.
Mm-hmm.
If you had to set everything back, that conversely makes patients look older, but that's obviously not what we're doing. That being said, it is not a treatment designed for anti-aging. But it's, there's obviously overlap between these reconstructive and cosmetic paradigm. When you do a facelift or a neck lift, one of the key things to look at is someone's chin. Because
mm-hmm.
if someone has a quote unquote weak chin, then it's going to affect their appearance of the neck. And if someone has, without getting too, again, specific, like a more class two relationship where mm-hmm. the chin is more retrusive and the upper jaw is a little bit more forward, then by bringing that skeletal balance, you can really essentially, just like real, if you were to jar out, what do we call this maneuver, where you thrust your chin forward, it's going to tighten your neck. And so sometimes doing a genioplasty at the time of a facelift is a useful adjunct. And in that similar way, by bringing the mandible or the jaw forward as part of sleep apnea, it can often improve the appearance of the neck. And then similarly, by moving the upper jaw forward, it can improve the fullness in the cheek and relift the appearance of the cheek in a similar way that filler tries to do from the outside. Often filler in the cheek, you're injecting it right onto the bone
mm-hmm.
to then not only give fullness, but give the skin a little bit more tension and smoothness.
Okay. Well, as you can tell, folks, I'm definitely going down the path of my next consultation with Dr. E. I want to thank you, number one. And I have to tell everybody that, as I mentioned before, I've had several procedures over the course of my life, and I can't say enough about getting through the procedure and coming out the other end and what it's done to not only reinforced me feeling my best, shaping my confidence, giving me a little bit of a pep in my step. I don't know what that it is for everybody else who's gone through similar procedures, but I do have to say, you get one chance around the sun. And if you can, and if you're willing, and if you're open to it, I would highly recommend Dr. Edward Davidson. He's the best. And again, we'll put where he can be found in the show notes once the podcast drops. And I just want to thank everybody for tuning in this morning. And you know what to do. You can follow, share, and mind your nest. And please give us a 5-star review. Thank you so much, everybody. And we'll see you next time.